Live from the parking lot of Thomas Ewan Consolidated High School in Chamberlain, Maine, where the 1979 prom is just about to catch fire. Do you smell smoke? It's...
The Dark Multiverse of Stephen... The Dark Multiverse of... The Dark Multiverse of...
Oh my god. It's the Dark Multiverse of Stephen King, okay?
So, yeah, let's talk about Cujo.
Yes.
Now, we both recently seen the movie and listened to a really very good audiobook version. Now, you didn't like it at first, right?
Okay. I don't care for that woman's voice, and the reason why is because I feel like my grandmother is reading me a story, and that would be fine. Dude, if my grandma could read me a scary bedtime story, that would be like tits. Like, I'd be so happy for the rest of my life. That would be like my one wish if I could have her back. But there was something about it that when she was going through more screechier panic voices, I didn't care for her voice, and it woke me up sometimes when I'd fall asleep listening to it, because I kind of like, almost like Zelda from Pet Sematary movie, where it was like that screeching, like, I'm gonna, and I didn't wake up scared. I just woke up like, who are you? Fuck you. Like, I need to sleep. And then I'm like, oh, I did this to myself. So there's something about her voice that just brought on this weird grandma shrill quality.
Yeah, I really liked her reading. And it's interesting, you know, I've been sampling the various audiobooks of Stephen King's, and they're all over the map. Some are, as we talked about, millions on the Michael C. Hall
or Kathy
stuff,
Bates.
Or the Kathy Bates ones are incredible. A number are fine. I liked this one. There are others that I think are just terrible. And I thought she got progressively better as it went along. Interesting story about her. She's primarily a stage actress. She's only made a few movies. Have you ever seen the movie called Drag Me to Hell?
Yes, I have. Alison Lohman, yeah.
Yeah, and and the old gypsy woman that curses her?
Yeah.
That's her.
Oh my God, no way.
She's a character actress, primarily does stage work. She was pulled in to do specifically.
I gotta check Netflix
to do,
and watch that again.
And she's got, you know, she's the classic gypsy cliche.
Right.
She's got the huge nose and the wart and the whole thing. That's her in full makeup, but that's the woman that did this.
Oh my God, that's great.
Yeah, and I really liked it, but either way, I think it's one of the better readings, whether the voice bothers you person or not. If
that
you don't like it, But I thought
it was well. I mean, she read it well. I just didn't care for her voice.
I understand that. Yeah. There are others where I just can't. And since they're bad, they just don't work.
Does it grate on you?
Yeah. Remember, campers, we are all about the spoilers here. We just take it for granted, like the entitled middle-class Americans we are, that you have read the books and seen the movie we're discussing here today. And if you haven't, you'd be a lot happier if you went off and did that now before we started yapping at you. So take your time. You know we'll still be here when you get back, okay? So here we go. But for Cujo, so we've both read the book and seen the movie.
And we are
a little bit like Pet Sematary. There's a lot more in the book than I remembered. To remind folks, I've read these books since they've been published. Some of them I haven't read since they've been published.
Right.
So I remember reading Cujo when it came out, but it came out 25 years ago. And I haven't really had occasion to go back and read the book in that long.
Exactly.
So it's almost like, I mean, constantly surprised about how much is in these stories. Pet Sematary was the best example. There's a lot more to Cujo than just a woman and her kid trapped in a car.
That's all I remember from seeing this movie as a kid is the Pinto. I described the color to Brad, and he's like, yep, and that's the scene in the movie. I was like, oh my God, I have seen it when I was a kid. But you're right. It's not about that at all. There's so much more. And I didn't remember that until we watched the movie. And then now after having read the book or the audiobook, I really noticed that, like, there really is so much more about the people.
Once again, of course, the movie is very different than the book. One of the interesting things is I'm listening to the book, we're going along, and, you know, they're establishing all these characters and getting everything signed up, lined up and everything. It is almost exactly halfway through the book
that the movie starts.
That, well, where she gets trapped in the car. But all you think about is that the book's about this woman being trapped in a car by a rabid dog. That's half the book.
Exactly.
And it's not even all of that. I mean, she doesn't even get to the
that's something that I found so interesting, and I think it made it kind of hard for me initially to get into, because his older stuff does move slower because he was trying to establish himself as a good writer, not just a horror hack or whatever, you know? So Stephen King was like, I want to tell a good story, and that includes all of this, which this was very good because it was short. It wasn't too over-detailed or anything like that. It got to the points, but the points were not about the rabid dog and the lady stuck in the car.
It's only one
like
of the
saying.
Three stories.
Yes, there's so much more going on.
About the crisis that the husband is having with his business.
Sharp cereal.
And, yeah, with sharp cereal. Nothing wrong here, verstehen Sie? Anyway, but the other part is about the artist, the crazy artist guy, and her whole affair and that whole thing. Their crisis
handyman,
in a marriage.
Handyman guy.
Yeah, the handyman guy.
Mm-hmm. He's a wood artist, so yeah.
But the crisis in their marriage is a third piece. And in the book, they're almost given equal weight. The other two stories are overwhelmed by her life-threatening experience at the end of the book.
Right.
But he spends a lot of time building those up.
And that was what was so great about the book. I mean, honestly, okay, the movie, we always talk about this part, if we liked it or not, highly entertaining. I really enjoyed it. It was more detailed than I remembered as a kid. But when you go to the book, I really had forgotten that it is a parade. It's a parade of the woman and her affair. It's the man and his, you know, whole thing with his job and the people he has to work with in his job. I mean, it gets detailed in that way.
Yeah, his partner and the guys that are their biggest account and all that other stuff. Yeah,
and how the owner of the company is going to react and his shithead son. I mean, they even get that detailed. I mean, he did such a great job with writing this. It was so fascinating to me. And I enjoyed every leg of it, where sometimes in books, not Stephen King in particular, but any book, I kind of, when it goes from one chapter to the next where it switches topics, I'm just, when I'm getting interested, then you switch over to the next one and then I'm like, and I'm not. And then I get sucked into that aspect of it. But this one, it's like a constant, it's a parade. It's not back and forth and back and forth. You're interested the whole time and you get more interested as you go.
And there's a weird lesson to be learned too about how wrapped up the husband gets in his whole business thing and the scandal and all this.
That he forgets about the car.
And forgets about the car and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And how unimportant that is when his wife and child are threatened, when their life is threatened. So that when he finally gets the news that they get to keep the account, it almost doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter anymore. What had built up for his character to be so important is just like...
Yeah, now he realizes what really is important in his life. Yeah. And I thought that was an interesting theme for the book about what really matters and what doesn't.
Actually, that's perfect. That's the essence, I think. Mm-hmm. What really matters and what doesn't. This episode of The Dark Multiverse of Stephen King is brought to you by Red Apron, the make-your-own-meal delivery service that brings the best of multiverse cuisine directly to you. Every week, Red Apron drops an unmarked shipping crate outside your door, then knocks and runs away. And what you'll find inside will make your heart pound. Guaranteed. Every secret shipment is filled with dark delicacies you've never dared to dream of, from places you can never, ever visit. Well, not if you know it's good for you. This week alone, start with a tasty corn fritter appetizer from the Sweetbriar Rose Diner in Chester's Mill, Maine. After all, you'll never get a chance to visit the real restaurant. It's almost impossible to get in. Then, fill your plate with a cheeky cut of blood red beef from the Gotham Cafe, where the knives are always extra sharp and the service is insane. And then you can finish what might be the last great meal of your lifetime by making your own super savory strawberry pie, complete with a secret ingredient that might actually make you thinner. Then, just like every month, you can end your evening once and for all with a new and inconsolable cocktail from Lloyd the bartender, the evil genius mixologist, you know, the one lurking behind the bar at the Overlook Hotel. His drinks are to die for. This month, the Bloody Virgin Mary, a perfect libation to enjoy on a cold winter's night before the snow makes it impossible to leave anyway. You'll find all that and way too much more at Red Apron, the mysterious meal delivery service that brings the multiverse to you. Learn more by visiting redapron.co, that's redapron.co, and click on the help me button. You won't believe, or maybe even survive, what happens next. And thanks again to Red Apron for sponsoring this episode of The Dark Multiverse of Stephen King.
I actually found a flaw in the book, something that bothered me.
Ooh.
Well, he builds up the third story about the handyman who gets more and more weird and then trashes their place.
I think he got too much time on that for the
then
traveling.
He just disappears. He doesn't even write the scene, or maybe he wrote it and left it out of the book finally, where the cops go and confront that guy.
They don't confront him. They just say they were able to trace that he's still in the state or something. That's well, it.
Well, then they went and talked to him. They said something like they went and talked to him. He couldn't have been the guy that did it because he was already out of state. But it just peters out.
It does,
just trails
right.
away. And it's like, why did you go to all
I
the trouble?
Didn't even think about
that. I like the affair part.
Yeah.
But she never has a big scene where she confronts him completely. A Stephen King kind of.
Right.
Almost to blows, like we did get in Pet Sematary, where there's all these good face-to-face things between the wife and the husband. And then he doesn't have any last big, like, confrontation with the cops when
I mean,
they think
he
was a kidnapper.
I mean, he just jerked off on the bed, and that was it.
Yeah. And then he just kind of wanders away. And it's like, that was weird. It's like,
that is
why didn't he finish
like
that story?
The feeling that I get from just kind of the recollection, and I don't know if this is what happened in the book, but I just got the feeling that, like, they caught up with him and were like, oh, yeah, he admitted to doing this, and that's it. That's the end. And then by then, Donna's in the car, and she's been rescued finally, and so that's the focus of it. But you're right. I kind of would have liked to maybe have him sent to Shawshank.
Well, in a literary, in a literary structure sense, he's a true red herring. The cops follow him as thinking he's the kidnapper. That
right.
He may have taken them.
Yeah.
Or that she may have gone with him willingly or unwillingly.
Mm-hmm.
And we follow along. And I get that was his chief role in the book. But then it's as if once he's done that, King loses interest in his story and doesn't even close it off in his typical good storytelling style. And then, of course, you forget about that, too, because the final ending, the last 50 pages less the epilogue of this book are so strong.
Oh my gosh, they're so amazing. Yeah. I had to listen to it like over again. I was like, you had 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, and then I had to just kind of sit myself down and like listen to the last hour and a half like twice. I had to.
Okay, all about Cujo. First published in 1981, won the British Fantasy Award in 1982. King, by the way, named the dog after one of the leaders of the Symbionese Liberation Army, the revolutionaries who kidnapped Patty Hearst back in 1974. Is anybody but me old enough to even remember any of this? The SLA, Hearst, Cujo? Never mind. Anyway, the movie Cujo premiered pretty quickly in 1983, starring, among others, Dee Wallace and Hugh Daniel Kelly. Dee Wallace, who had just finished playing the mom in E.T., went on to become one of the first scream queens. She was in the original The Hills Have Eyes, and in The Howling, and even Critters, and she's still working today. In fact, she's part of the new Rob Zombie movie, Three from Hell. Hugh Daniel Kelly went from a zillion episodes of Ryan's Hope to Cujo, and then almost immediately to co-star in the Stephen J. Cannell TV series Hardcastle and McCormick. Anyone? Really? Am I talking to myself here? Anyway, he's still kicking around, too. You can see him doing, you know, guest star stints and TV dramas every now and then. Financially, the movie didn't do great. Made a little over $20 million in 1983 dollars, which ranks it right in the middle of the 40-plus movies based on Stephen King properties that have actually been released theatrically. Maybe that's why it's never been remade, but it is a cornerstone Castle Rock book, and it's mentioned often in the Castle Rock TV series. All the morbid tales about the St. Bernard that went rabid back in 1980. You can rent the movie on Amazon for, $3.99, though it's not currently on Amazon Prime, Netflix, or Hulu, or Shudder. We'll talk a bit about the audiobook, and we don't agree on its quality, but I liked it, and it's available through audible.com right now. The print and e-versions are available too, of course, but somebody explained to me why the Kindle edition is $10.99, when you can get a paperback of Cujo for as little as $2.99. I get that. Other interesting stuff. Cujo was originally going to be directed by somebody else entirely. Peter Medak, who directed The Ruling Class and Romeo is Bleeding, among many other things. That would have been a really much more interesting movie, but there was some kind of drama in the last few days of production, and he and his cinematographer left, and Warner Brothers brought in Louis Teague, who's a solid, workmanlike director, one of Roger Corman's go-to guys. Teague is probably best known for directing this and King's Cat's Eye a couple of years later, and The Jewel of the Nile shortly after that. Interestingly, the cinematographer on Cujo was John DeBont, who later went into directing himself things like Speed and Twister and Lara Croft Tomb Raider Cradle of Life. But let's end with this. Remakes aside, Sun Classic Pictures sent out a release back in 2015 saying they were developing a new movie of the same title, or something like the same title. It was going to be called C-U-J-O, Cujo, which stood for Canine Unit Joint Operations. King called the idea diseased. Nothing ever came of it. Okay, back to it.
I was about two-thirds of the way through the audiobook when I watched the movie.
Oh.
And I hadn't quite finished it. So I saw that, then went back and finished the audiobook. And it was just kind of the way my time worked out
right.
for it. But of the two, which did you like better, the book or the movie?
Okay. The movie was super fun, but the book was great. I mean, it took me a long time. Like I said, I had to really every time get over that lady's voice, but that was just a personal thing. But I would...
You're always allowed to go back and read the paper version. You know, you don't have to listen to
it. And you know what? I own the paper version. That's
the
worst part
of
it. Yes,
it
is. Yeah. I'm like, the worst part is I actually own it. I want to hear it in my own voice. So I probably will end up reading it soon. Because I loved the Camber's wife and son. I loved hearing all about the stories. And I thought that it was so cool that when she goes to visit her sister after she basically blackmails and negotiates with her husband because he's a fucking drunk and she wants to just be away from him as much as possible. But I guess divorce wasn't an option. You know, she's too scared or whatever.
Ultimately, she decided. I mean, she had it all worked out.
Yeah. And she went, but she didn't, like, leave, you know. And I think it's implied in the movie probably that she was leaving him. But in the book, it's kind of like, I'm going to just leave and see what happens.
Well, but then she goes and you know, her son's there and he starts to act more and more like Camber and it worries you more and more. And then she makes the decision to go back.
Yeah, I mean, because she says, oh, I kind of like those things about Joe. All in all, the snootiness or whatever kind of wears off from the sister
and her
husband.
Yeah, she found that she didn't like those people as much as she thought she would. Didn't want to be like them as much as she thought she would.
See, and these stories are what I find the most interesting about the book because, and I want to keep talking about this because
you're right. So that's a fifth story in the book. And I forgot.
Yeah,
the Cambers,
yeah.
Their whole deal is another arc.
They have a whole
unrelated
family arc.
To the deal.
Yes, exactly.
And this is what I think we misremember the earlier King books as being single stories.
Right.
And at some point, we'll actually go back and read Carrie, his very first book. My
God,
recollection is
that.
That's a single story.
See, no, I remember Carrie as the most beautiful tapestry, not even a beret, it's a tapestry.
But in many of these other books, what we're finding as we go back and reread these, is that no, when he's writing a short story, it's one thing. It's, you know, the rats under the mill or whatever.
Yeah, uh-huh.
One beautiful punch to the gut.
Yes.
Whenever he writes a book, there's not one story. There are three or four or five, even in the books we remember as the book about the dog and the car. No,
and this
that's
is maybe
only...
why it's so lovely to have this multiverse of Stephen King that everybody loves so much that's a Stephen King fan, because the Cambers could have their own story, but he never touches on that. I mean, there's so many short story characters that I would love to see them in a novel, but that never happens either.
Yeah.
But they still exist.
They're
real.
And it is a true novel. It is a layered telling of different
really
stories that reflect on each other, even if they don't interact. Like
The
whole Camber story takes place completely independent, well, other than Camber's death. I mean, everything we talk about the husband and the wife and the affair and the dog has nothing to do with her going off. And it isn't until the very end that she
Donna
even knows
and
that.
And Vic and their marriage. And okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all that stuff is interconnected.
Also,
But really, from the time she leaves and goes off, her whole story of whether she's going to get divorced or not, what it's going to mean, all that is
with
almost unrelated with the Cambers. Okay. It's totally unrelated to the rest of it. And it's
really
a damn good story.
It really is. One of the parts that I loved about it, and this just goes to show the vividness and detail, depth of character and everything, her and her son, you know, this was a few days before they decided to go back because he hasn't heard back from his father to see if Cujo is okay because he seems sick before he left.
Mm-hmm.
He and his mom are speaking about her sister. I can't remember her name, but Brett talks about how the sister is flashing her credit cards out. And at first he finds them very snooty. And then it finally comes down to a normal conversation, not one where she's feeling defensive and he's just really kind of wondering and he's making his own judgments from where he comes from.
Yeah.
He says, well, at lunch, you know, she kind of flashed her credit cards around and it seemed kind of obvious. And she kind of feels angry in a flare of herself for a second. And then she realizes, no, he's right.
It
bothered me too. And then he becomes sweet and soft, which shows that he's more like his mother than his hard Joe Camber's father, where he says, you know, maybe still sometimes she feels poor too. So she needs to flash those credit cards. And I'm like, this is a side story of a side story. Like, this is just the guy that fixes the car once at the very beginning. And we're learning all about
his
family.
And he's an early victim. I mean, he's the dog owner and he's an early victim. But that was his only purpose. Mm-hmm. And that easily, they could have just gone off to visit and as they do in the movie, basically, and are never seen again.
You never see him again.
And it's a non-horror story. It doesn't end up bloody or weird.
Well, I mean, other than the bodies that got killed by the dog.
No, I mean, the Camber story, when they go off. That whole story of her realization of herself, her marriage, and her son.
Yes, and the life that they're living.
Yeah, that's a novel. That's a story, but it's not a horror story. It's part of a horror novel.
Yes.
And it's only because he draws these people so beautifully and tells these stories so well that you want to read, that you remember that, going back and reading it, as vividly as you remember, again, those crazy last 50
Absolutely.
Pages.
Absolutely, yeah. I wasn't in a rush to get through those
right.
to get
Neither
to the...
Neither was I. It was get back to the dog.
Exactly.
Yeah, in general, I like the book better than the movie again, and I probably almost always will.
Probably.
We'll see. That's why I think soon we'll be doing one that was an original screenplay, so there isn't any book to compare it to, and that'll be good.
Yes,
but,
it will.
And part of it is how surprised I have been yet again at how much is going on in these books. They're not the simple little horror stories, scary stories. Mm-hmm. There's an actual novel with real people.
There's
in
real
it.
Horror. I mean, that's the thing. Did you ever see the movie Quarantine?
With
lady I've that used to be in Dexter, or used to be married to Michael C. Hall and was in Dexter as a sister. She was in that movie. And the thing that I loved about that movie so much is the same exact thing that I love about Cujo. It's rabies. It's something
it's like a modified
it's
rabies.
Well, that's an accelerated rabies, but this is just normal rabies. And I love that in Cujo, I mean, this is a disease. It's a real thing. There's nothing you can do about it. You can't prevent rabies, but there is the cure. But only if you see the symptoms. If you don't, then the dog goes crazier and crazier, and you've got this person going that way, this person going that way. I really like that. I love rabies. I mean, I don't want rabies.
It's
but
interesting that...
When I brush my teeth, I do get a little rabid.
There's a hint in the movie. There's a hint of the supernatural because he sees the ghost of the dog in his closet. Well, we realize later, right at the beginning.
Frank Dodd.
It's Frank Dodd. Okay. Yeah, but that was what I found interesting, too, is of course they couldn't do that in the movie, but they didn't take out the scene itself where he was seeing a monster in the closet.
Yeah, and she even saw it, too, and smelled it.
But it's the only supernatural element in this whole book. This is a non-supernatural horror novel.
And it could be just... people's imaginations that all live in the same house and there's maybe a dead rat. I mean, that's not what it is, but I'm just saying, like, it could be explained in a non-supernatural way.
And the other thing is when the sheriff gets killed by the dog.
Okay.
Where he's pinned down, basically, and the dog's about to rip his throat out. He looks up in the dog's eyes, and he sees Frank Dodd's eyes.
Okay, I missed that part completely. Okay,
he had this moment where he thought, oh, my God.
Okay, that was in the book, right?
Yeah, it's in
the
book.
No, she even thought in the book, Donna, the mom, she thought that Cujo recognized her, that Cujo was seeing her indiscretion with Steve.
That there are moments where the dog is assigned an almost supernatural intelligence that made him even worse than he was. And that was fine, but it wasn't really important to the story. And even the Frank Dodd tie-ins.
I think it was just because, like, the omnibus book that I have that has the Dead Zone and then the second story, and so it's two stories, and then it's just the Dead Zone and Cujo.
Yeah. And as we saw in Castle Rock, too, all that stuff is tied together. And, of course, this was the death of the sheriff who was replaced by Pangborn, who will be around almost any second now. So it was real interesting stuff.
So I would have to say the only part of the book of Cujo that I was not a huge fan of, but it does make sense, was when it was written from the dog's perspective. But I understand that it has to be, because otherwise you would have to involve the CDC or some outside person that's explaining what's going on. So, and they were very short chapters. So that,
then,
like,
yeah,
you kept, pointed
he,
out, you
he
said,
kept that to a minimum. And I understand, like, in the opening where he talks about the good dog.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that I think King was trying to establish is that this was a good dog. There are a couple other scenes.
He was a very good dog.
Where, like, and with the boy, his boy, the first time he meets Vic's kid, where you get a sense of what a good, big, floppy,
lovely dog he is.
And,
and even Tad, Vic's kid, is like, doggy, Cujo.
Cujo, yeah. That's so. And I think that's why he went that way, which you're right. It could have gotten really oppressive in the latter part if he continued to build up this evil intelligence inside the dog. And he that would have been outside dumb as fuck, and it I was really that. Smart to not get inside the dog's head.
No, yeah, exactly.
Other just than he was really uncomfortable or was burning all the time. The bright light hurt his eyes
and the water, he was afraid of it. He wanted to drink it, but he was too afraid of it. And it's like, you know, all the rabid symptoms. So I think it was good.
So my own sense is, you're right. Watching the movie is a lot of fun. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah,
it screams 80s.
Screams 80s. We just watched Pet Sematary, and I'm like, yep, this is 80s. Here we go again.
It's partly the people in it, all of the actors in it. You've got, you know, the guy from Hardcastle and McCormick. You've got Dee Wallace, who went on to do all the other Screamy movies. And all of the other character actors in this are just, these are guys that it was such a standard kind of 80s thing that you can't avoid it.
No.
Obviously, there's one... I mean, I liked the movie fine. It was a lot of fun. I'd watch it again at some point in the future. But the big thing is the ending. Now, in the book, I'm not even going to go to the spoiler alert thing because we already have. But in the book, the boy dies.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
And in the movie, the boy doesn't die.
Okay, that was a fucking surprise. Okay, so that's another reason why I listened to the last hour and a half, because I wanted to build up that own suspense within myself just to get to the, like, Tad, wait. In the movie, she puts him on the counter, she does CPR on him, and then eventually he comes back after minutes of panic. He fucking dies in
the car.
I love it. It's fucked up. I mean, I was like, thank you, Stephen King, for kissing Richard Bachman and then just going and writing the last bit of this book. You really ended it in a fucked up, awesome way.
The weird thing is, the fact that they changed the ending in the movie didn't bother me. Now, I remember when it came out,
and there
was a big hue and cry that they had changed it. They hadn't done the right ending.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
People were upset.
It was a big, because they changed the ending. And I thought, no, you experienced the movie in an hour and a half.
Completely different way, in a short condensed.
A short deal, and you buy into these characters. And I don't know how you could end that movie with the parents surviving and the kid dying.
Yeah.
And not feel somehow cheated in the movie experience.
Right.
In the book, I would have felt exactly the opposite. If that kid had survived after all of the horror, I mean, the description of how bad she looked at the end and how...
She was on the brink of death herself.
Yeah, that had he survived, it would have been so melodramatic and so easy.
If he would have made Tad live in the book, I would have been pissed. Yeah. If he would have made Tad die in the movie, I would have been pissed. Yeah, it was perfect.
So the folks that made these two things for all the other changes that they made.
Sure.
And like there are in the movie, there are minor passes at Camber's D story down there.
Right.
There's a little bit about the sharp serial thing that kind of peters out.
And there's a little bit about Frank Dodd and the...
Always mention, but again, I can't mention because they don't own the rights. But there's a little bit of the supernatural part in there. There's the affair thing, which...
The affair.
By the way, are you aware that Dee Wallace, the one who plays the mom in this, and the guy that plays her lover, that's her husband?
No fucking way.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, Stone. Yeah, they were married for years. I think they were married until his death, actually. They've been married before this movie was made. They made two or three movies together.
Oh, I like that.
She was Dee Wallace Stone. For years, and he was Chris Stone. He died of a heart attack 10 years ago, a long time ago. And she's continued to work and do stuff. So those scenes had that electricity between them.
Well, I thought that they did very well together. Their chemistry was very interesting to me. I didn't know that they were married.
Yeah,
but it makes sense. You know, I like the way that she talks to him, that kind of cold way or whatever. And, you know, there was a lot of rapey things in the book, more rapey than in the movie, which makes sense.
In the book, she has lost interest in him almost... from the outset, and then he keeps showing up and keeps inserting. In this one, the scene of her finally rejecting him is much more mild, much more like, I'm sorry, he kind of shrugs and
gives
she's
up. A very composed actress. I mean, everything that she says is very deliberate, and I kind of like that. She was very fun to watch. In the book, she was just like, without saying you were just a plaything, she basically makes him feel like a plaything, and he really was. So
yeah, she's a much more complicated character in the book. Well, and this is a few of the problems with the movie, even given its time and having to cut out all the secondary plots to try to focus on the one. One of the problems is that she doesn't look bad enough by the end.
No, and here's the thing. She's still, I don't know if you noticed this, but the very fucking end, she still has two shirts on. So she's got her bra on, she has a tank top, and she has her shell top on top of it. Who the fuck does that? If I'm losing fucking water faster than I can, you know, have any way to get any... No.
The director, Louis Teague, is
should have taken her shirt off.
Yeah, he's a competent director, but you don't really get any of the sense of the claustrophobia or the heat or their desperation inside that car.
There should have been condensation on the windows and windshield just from their breath alone over time.
Part of the problem, of course, is this is all practical. They had to, like, make up the dog.
Oh, by the way, I wanted to say that. I'm glad you brought this up. The dog, in my opinion, is the best actor that I've ever seen of any dog of any movie, and probably the best actor in this movie. He should have won a fucking award. This dog, putting on all that makeup and all the shit that he does from being sweet to being scary, it's amazing.
But there were things they just couldn't, like, when he does look you in the eye, he's still got a big brush brown eyes. They couldn't make him look evil enough and dangerous enough, except with all of the, you know, the shit on him and everything else.
And this kid cries too fucking much in the movie.
And that's the last thing I want to say. King has kids in a lot of his books, and sometimes they're very strong kids.
And quiet, silent types.
Like the kid in Salem's Lot, and there are plenty of others.
Yes.
The young boy becoming a man and all that stuff. Danny from Shining is an excellent example. And then occasionally he has the kind of kids where they're whiny little shits that fall into infantilism almost immediately, and you hate their guts.
I hated this kid.
The kid in the original Mist and in the movie is like it. So is Tad.
Right.
He's the same way. From the beginning, he's a whiny little cretin.
Yes.
And I just hate him. And as a parent, as you know, now as grown kids, I can tell you that there are times when you hate your children. Yeah, you love them and you'll die for them. But there are times when they're just, when they have a cold for the third day and they're just doing nothing but whine. And you just want to wring their necks.
Yeah.
And there's a movie, a non-Stephen King horror movie called Mom and Dad that's out right now.
Oh, I wanted to see that with Nicolas Cage.
And there's a line near the end of it where he says, "You don't understand. Your mother and I love you, but sometimes," and of course the whole movie is about them killing their children.
Yes.
And not just them, but everybody. Yes. Every parent should kill their children. And it's true. And every parent will say, there's sometimes.
Right, just wanna,
and that kid is a perfect example of the sometimes kid.
Yeah.
I would have throttled that little
You're in a scolding hot car. You have a vicious dog after you. And the dog actually bites and attacks her. And she's bleeding. She's overheating. She's dehydrating. You know, she's burning more calories. She's trying to do all these things. And that little fucker won't shut the fuck up.
And it's the same way in the book, too. He's no help. He screeches and he whines and he becomes and starts sucking his thumb and doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it was an interesting kind of risky portrayal of the kid in the book. So when he does finally shut the hell up at the end, not dead, we don't know he's dead yet.
Yes,
you're
when
almost
he did
relieved.
Shut up, I got relieved.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even feel worried. I didn't feel worried. I just felt like, oh, thank God. Because I just was like, no more Tad, please. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I just thought that was an interesting choice for King to make in the book and an equally interesting choice for the screenwriter and the director for the movie. They didn't make him a nice kid. And of course, we all know Danny Pintauro went on to be the kid in Who's the Boss for 1,000 years.
Oh,
and
my
then
God.
One of the first child actors to come out as gay. Who
I didn't know that.
Came out. And he still is. He left the business shortly after that, didn't get any more
Good
work. I don't
him.
Think he wanted it. And last thing I heard is still very happy. So let's wrap it up. Anything else to say about Cujo?
I liked it. I look forward to doing something more modern just because I want to compare the writing style contrast and or movies or whatever. I just want to like feel more horrific instead of, like we were saying, cool people living their lives in their fucked up way, however they do, and then something bad happens to them and how they deal with it, which is great and horrifying in and of itself, but I want something fucking horrifying.
Yeah, well, very soon.
Did I just go too low there?
It's coming low. You can never go too low in any sense of that word. Anyway, thanks. I'm glad I read the book. I would suggest that anybody that wants to read a good King book, don't skip over Cujo. It's a good, strong book, way better than we remember it to be.
It really is.
Not terribly long. Again, if you're looking at audiobooks, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I liked it. She didn't, but it's certainly one of the better produced.
So Rochambeau and kick yourself in the balls and then decide if you want to spend the money on it or not.
Yeah, or listen, or, you know, preview it on Audible for the first 20 minutes. And if you just can't, like you would have stopped there.
I would have stopped. If this wasn't an assigned thing, I would have stopped.
Yeah. That was fun.
All right. Love you guys. Don't love you.
There you go.
Hate you and want to murder you, but.
Go pee.
Okay.
Let's do the skeleton keys for episode 2, Habeas Corpus.
Okay. Sure. Basically, Warden Lacey's narration opens it up. The rabid dog is, of course, Cujo.
Of course.
And the Strangler refers to Frank Dodd from the Dead Zone. The boy down the railroad tracks is the boy found in the body, a.k.a. Stand By Me.
Sounds good. And then a few minutes later, in our first time of going into the Church mm-hmm. of the Incarnation, we meet Jackie Torrance.
Love it.
So it's going to be a couple episodes where we see how full her connection to the other Jack Torrance is, but clearly The Shining mm-hmm. is in there somewhere.
Yes, got to mention The Shining. Warden Lacey's file folder, once again, references Cujo and the body, and also references a fire in the oddity shop Needful Things.
Yeah, it's the only mention so far of Needful Things, even though Alan Pangborn was right exactly.
Yes, you would think it'd be mentioned all the time.
Yeah, without... yeah, interesting that it isn't. Then, of course, there's the dive bar, the Mellow Tiger that gets mentioned, and it is in a bunch of different stories.
It really is, I remember.
It's a major part of Needful Things, but it turns out to be a major part of this,
Castle
too.
Rock. But, yeah. Of the actual Castle Rock, not just the show.
Just the show.
The real place. And while sitting in the Tiger, Jackie and Henry both refer to Nan's Luncheonette. I love that conversation between them, which has been a major landmark in Castle Rock. Mentioned in Needful Things, The Sun Dog, The Dark Half, et cetera, et cetera. How they say what happens is so fantastic.
There's also, it mentions how the town was disincorporated a few years earlier.
Yeah.
So that's literally not on the map anymore.
Yes, it's
disincorporated. And if you look at the map in the title sequence that's there that shows mm-hmm. all the other towns, it doesn't show Castle Rock.
And you have Haven there, and it even shows Crash Site, but you don't
Derry,
have Castle Rock.
Yeah, because
it's been disincorporated.
Not on the map anymore.
It got blown off the fucking map.
Yeah.
But I love it because he asks her, what's the real story? And she's asking him, what's the real story? And then I love that Nan's Luncheonette is a brothel.
Yeah, a fuck club in the back room.
It was a fuck club in the back room.
Never guessed that before.
I wouldn't have guessed that ever, especially not having all the people from Needful Things that work there, like the lady with the dog and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And the last thing is that when Henry meets with Alan at night in the garden there, mm-hmm. and he's unburying, he's digging
up
the dog.
Oh, my God.
Who was a neighborhood bitch, but Henry's mother wanted him to get dug up because nothing stays dead in this town.
Hello, Pet Cemetery.
Yeah, straight up Pet Cemetery.
And when they dug up the dog, it's in like a suitcase or something. Mm-hmm. The dog is not covered in maggots. The dog's eyes are intact. The dog looks like, even though it's months, he's like, a few months back, your mom's bitch got
it
hit.
He said did it on New Year's Day.
So it gives a time reference.
And now we're in the fall. So.
And the dog is not decayed at all.
Yeah.
So, she might not be so out of her mind, even though she's totally fucking crazy and out of her mind.
Well, maybe she is, maybe she isn't. That's pretty much everything we found in episode 2, and we'll come back next week and do episode 3.
Yay!
And that's it for episode 3 of The Dark Multiverse of Stephen King and The Mist. We give you links to all the versions in the show notes over at www.darkmultipod.com. And as always, please join us on Twitter at darkmultipod or on Instagram at darkmultipod, or drop us a note with suggestions or supplemental info or secret formulas for world peace at darkmultipod@gmail.com. Once again, our beautiful and haunting theme and bed music is used by the generous permission of Chrysanthi Tan, a brilliant musician, composer, and performer. Visit her website at chrysanthitan.com. That's like chrysanthemum without the mum. Get it? No? There's a link on our website, too, so one way or another, go visit. And become one of her very lucky patrons over on Patreon. You can follow Brad at TheBradMunson on Twitter, or visit his website at bradmunson.com. But as for Kat, well, I dare you to try to find Kat Bentley on social media. It's like searching for a 24-karat diamond in a bucket full of broken glass. Thanks for joining us. Like us, review us, but only in a positive way. Tell your friends how totally cool your new favorite podcast is, and that someday you hope it'll move in next door so you can get married. Until then, see you soon.
So, cheers.
Ooh, nice laugh. Nice one. Crash, shatter both glasses.
I was just thinking that. I'm like, God, that's so much glass in my bed.